calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, CRN Digital, and AirAmericaRadio.com. Welcome back to our program. Larry Korb is with us with the Center for American Progress. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, and was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for the United States of America from 1981 to 1985. Larry Korb, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. The elections are happening in Iraq right now, and if it's my sense of it is that if there is true democracy, or if there's anything resembling that, that is to say, if you know a majority will prevails, Iraq is very soon going to be aligned with Iran. Am I missing something?
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that the Shiites will have a big say, if not completely dominate the government. And the Shiites and the Iranians are both of the same denomination of Muslims, if you will. And that they will have a very close relationship. In fact, people like Chalabi have already visited Iran.
So is it possible that we could end up with what, at least from you would think the Bush perspective, would be the worst of all possible worlds, that we have converted Iraq from a bulwark against, from a defense against Iranian expansion into the region and the increase in Iranian influence, into an agent of that?
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that when this is over, when the United States leaves, that Iran will be more influential in Iraq and in the Persian Gulf area than it has ever been. The question becomes how they will use that influence and what they'll do with it. But Iran and Iraq have been traditional enemies. In fact, during the time I was in government, the United States basically supported Iraq and Saddam in his war against Iran.
Right. Yeah. So, but we have the Muslim Brotherhood, who just got a whole bunch of seats in the Egyptian parliament. The Muslim Brotherhood, which was the precursor, as it were, to Al Qaeda, the founder of it, was the, before he was executed by Sadat, was the guru of the fellow who is Osama bin Laden's spiritual godfather, physician. I'm forgetting his name, and I guess it's self-evident that the consequence of our actions in that area have been to inflame Islamic tensions. What's your take on what's happening with the elections today? What's your sense on how they're going?
I think the elections, they will go well for two reasons. Number one, the country's in a virtual lockdown. So, it's going to be very hard for, have a great amount of violence. And number two, all of the groups are voting for their own people. It's really when, an election is not a democracy, electocracy is not a democracy, because until you can get Sunnis who would vote for a Shiite or vice versa, or the Kurds, would vote for one of the others, you really don't have a democracy. So they're all going to turn out, they're going to vote for their party, and then the real challenge is going to be, okay, after the election, will the majority Shiites and the Kurds be willing to make the compromises necessary to incorporate the Sunnis into a national government or a national thing called
reconciliation.
Iraq.
Yeah, is 51% the magic number? I mean, is this, they have proportional representation under this new constitution?
Well, the magic number, for example, in the last election, the majority Shiite party got 48%, and then of course they became the dominant party. But the Kurds also got the honorary title of president. The prime minister was a Shiite. So the real question is, there'll probably be four parties. There'll be two Shiite parties, one more religious than the other, and you'll have the Sunnis and you'll have the Kurds. Will they get together and be willing to come up with the modifications to the Constitution that protect the rights of the Sunnis, as well as, you know, equally share all the oil resources? And will the government that's established be seen as independent of the United States and, you know, a true Iraqi national government?
What's your sense, Larry Korb, of the probabilities of any of those?
Well, I think the probability, to the extent that we stay there in large numbers, it decreases the probability. Because as long as the majority Shiites think we're there, they're not going to be as motivated to make the compromises as they would be if we said, look, all right, we're out of here in 2 years. So then they would say, well, gee, if we don't, then we're going to have, you know, violence. But right now, the incentive is not there because they know that we'll protect them if the Sunnis should get upset about the fact that they didn't keep the promises they made before the voting in the on the constitutional referendum.
It seems that we're speaking with Larry Korb. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He was formerly the Assistant Secretary of Defense here in the United States from 1981 to 1985, and Director of National Security, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Vice President Director of Studies, holder of the Maurice Greenberg Chair, et cetera, Brookings Institution. You have quite a CV here. And one of the things that I recall about the Paul Bremer era in Iraq was that we made major changes to their constitution, which made it much easier for large multinational corporations and out-of-country corporations or interests, let's say, to basically come in and strip mine Iraq, to export wealth from Iraq, to expropriate profits without significant limits with tariffs and things. That essentially kind of turned it into a neocon paradise, a laissez-faire paradise. Flat tax, 15%, outlawing labor unions in some sectors. Are these kinds of changes to the Constitution going to stick?
Well, I think the real key is that obviously is important, and that was under the so-called transitional law that Jerry Bremer put in there. But the real issue is, will church and state be separated? Will the rights of minorities be respected? Will the oil revenues be shared by all of the people rather than, you know, exactly, you know, where they are, and how much self-government will you have in each of the provinces? The other thing, I think that will change, and, you know, the Iraqis will take over their own oil, and a lot more of the contracts should go to Iraqis rather than outsiders. But the real key issue is this sharing political power.
Yeah, isn't there talk right now about the Iraqi oil industry being privatized and American and other companies coming in and buying up the oil fields?
It's the one thing privatized, but then, of course, you know, who gets the benefits? I mean, and that's the key thing. You know, will they sell, you know, the resources at, you know, market value? Will they able to... You know, how much will they get for it? I mean, those are, you know, a lot of the questions that have to be dealt with. Right now, the problem essentially is that they're not even producing as much oil as they did under Saddam because the insurgents keep blowing it up.
Right. But to what extent do you believe that the problems that we're facing with the insurgency in Iraq are the consequence of the disastrous economic condition of the country right now, as opposed to just the mere presence of the United States and other political issues?
The two are related because a lot of the Iraqis cannot believe that a country as powerful as the United States couldn't have got things shaped up more quickly.
They should have come to New Orleans.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for example, with the oil and providing security and getting the economy going, because that's what they were led to believe.
Yeah. So therefore, they think that we're doing this intentionally.
Right. And that's why, you know, 80%, as Jack Murtha has said several times, 80% of the Iraqis, all factions, want us out of there. And so they think that we're part of the problem rather than, you know, part of the solution. That goes back to the fact that we didn't have enough troops. We didn't provide them the right guidance of what to do when Saddam fell. In fact, the only guidance they had was to guard the oil ministries.
Right. So therefore... You know, they come after us, and so are you. Just to wrap this up, are you broadly optimistic about the process that's going on right now?
Well, let me put it this way. I think that unless the United States sets a deadline to get out, I'm not optimistic. I think if we continue to almost give them a blank check, you will not get them to do what they need to do, not only in terms of making the political compromises, but to assert what we would call civilian control over the military, where the military is not loyal to a particular tribe, but to a, you know, a real national government.
Right. So it's time for us to start pushing a little self-reliance, as
right,
it were.
That's right.
Yeah, Larry Korb with the Center for American Progress. Thank you so much for being with us, sir. AmericanProgress.org is the website.
Thanks a lot for having me, Tom.
Thank you, Larry. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Don't worry, we'll be gentle, and let nothing make us twitch. This new global economy is designed to keep us rich.
The billionaires for Bush. The billionaires for Bush, always marvelous music for the holiday. Welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. The Tom Hartman radio program. Iraq going to the polls. We will see how this shakes out. And I'm just going to, you know, withhold comment beyond stating the obvious. I mean, we talked with Larry Korb, and Larry, I think, is walking down the center, as probably he appropriately should. I'll go a little farther out on the edge. I don't think that we should engage in the fantasy that this isn't going to end up being the thing that's going to help Iran more than anybody else. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood. George W. Bush has basically just handed us over, or handed the best gift, the best holiday gift, if you want, possible to those elements of radical Islam out there. I mean, just period. And the thing that really and truly amazes me right now is how successful Bush has been, particularly since yesterday, the day before, when he started this conversation about, and in the speech he just gave about, I took the war, it was flawed intelligence, how successful he has been at changing the fundamental conversation. A few weeks ago here in the United States, we were having a conversation, and it was actually happening in the mainstream media, who have already forgotten it. We were having a conversation about what lies were being told by the Bush administration to Congress. Remember that? People from Congress saying, you know, Bush lied to me. If I had known then what I know now, and I'm not talking about the stuff that's happened between now and then. If I had known then the stuff that they were keeping from me, I would have voted differently. John Kerry coming out and saying this, Jack Murtha coming out, you know, John Kerry, a more or less progressive, sort of progressive, arguably compared to Jack Murtha anyway. You got Murtha, a very conservative Democrat, essentially saying the same thing, among others. And just a few weeks ago, the conversation was about, you know, Bush lied to us. Look, and they're in Time and Newsweek and articles in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, articles about how the Bush administration knew, for example, that one of their major informants who told them, Saddam, he's got these facilities, he's making biological weapons, he's got them hidden under his palaces, all this kind of stuff, that we'd gotten the information from the guy by torture, and that therefore the CIA considered it unreliable. And that information was passed along to the Bush administration. Bush knew that. Cheney knew that. Rumsfeld knew that. Rice knew that. But the members of Congress didn't know that. The members of the Senate didn't know that. The people in the press didn't know that. Presumably Judy Miller didn't know that. Not that I necessarily want to speak in defense of Judy Miller, but the point is that a couple of weeks ago we were having the conversation about the lies that Bush told, and by coming out, this is just such a brilliant PR strategy, by coming out and saying, yes, I accept responsibility for the flawed intelligence, and I'm going to do something about fixing it. What he has done is he has successfully changed the conversation from what were the lies that Bush told, how did he deceive Congress and the American people, to a discussion about, you know, flawed intelligence. And it's like the American press is just rolling over and going, oh, yeah, okay, flawed intelligence. That's what it's all about. So anyhow, as I said, we'll talk at greater length tomorrow about this. I think, you know, this is a process that is still going on. And other than the obvious take, I don't want to just, you know, berate the overemphasize the obvious. This totally changing subjects here from the Wall Street Journal is global warming killing the polar bears. From the Wall Street Journal, it may be the latest evidence of global warming. Polar bears are drowning. This is from an article by Jim Carlton. Scientists, for the first time, have documented multiple deaths of polar bears off Alaska. Now, here's the deal. Polar bears know how to swim and because they eat seals. And so, you know, they live on the ice. They breed on the ice. They have their babies on the ice, by and large. But they, you know, they jump into the water and they grab the seals and things. And they can swim even many miles. They can swim 5, 10, 15 miles if they have to get from ice floe to ice floe, that kind of thing. But now we have a situation where, because in September 2004, the polar ice cap has retreated 160 miles north of the northern coast of Alaska. Up until 2004, for a quarter century, they had been doing aerial surveys of the Alaskan coastline. And typically, once every other year, they would see a lone polar bear out there in the water drowning. In 2004, this most recent survey, they counted 10 polar bears in this one year swimming as far as 60 miles offshore. Extrapolation of survey data suggests that on the order of 40 bears may have been swimming in those areas and probably drowned. Richard Steiner, marine biology professor at the University of Alaska, says this is it. He says, for anyone who's wondered how global warming and reduced sea ice will affect polar bears, the answer is simple. They die. We're talking about the possible, you know, wiping out of polar bears because of global warming. You don't think global warming's real? Amazing. So, just, you know, step by step, the little things we learn. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Your arrogance you show, but the poor people know that it's all about the WTO. You may meet us with a smile, you may meet us with a frown, but you should know by now that we won't take this lying down, and it's all about the WTO.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Andy Bernstein is with us. Andrew Bernstein is the author of The Capitalist Manifesto. He's also a specialist in objectivism and business ethics at the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Andy, welcome to the program.
Good to be back, Tom.
Great to have you here. Andy, I have read your book.
Great.
And the Capitalist Manifesto. And it's a marvelous defense of capitalism. In fact, I would say effusive praise of capitalism. You, I think, in some ways correctly point out the rise of economic wealth and activity in many parts of the world, you know, associated with capitalism. But let's start at the beginning. Define capitalism.
Well,
I didn't find that in the book.
Oh, it's in the first chapter on what is capitalism. I'm basically agreeing with Ayn Rand's definition that capitalism is the system of individual rights, including property rights, in which all property is privately owned. So the fundamental is that's the system of individual rights that protects. We have a limited government to protect me from criminals, and you have a Bill of Rights to protect me from the government, basically. To protect me and you and all members of society from the initiation of force by either private citizens or the government.
Yeah, well, I got that. But, I mean, the word capital in capitalism implies the actual ownership of something. In other words, if I work for a living, I'm not a capitalist. If I even own a small business, I'm not a capitalist. But if I invest money in something and I get a return on that money, I am a capitalist. In other words, I'm putting out capital and I'm getting money back, right?
Yeah, I think that's why the name capitalism, which comes either from Marx or from some earlier French socialist, is a misnomer. I think the proper name for the system is individualism or even liberalism, which is the way it was known in the 18th and early 19th centuries.
And it still is in Europe.
Yes.
By the way, yeah, and in fact, that was my you know the probably the biggest problem I had with your book. No offense intended, was that I felt that you were talking in most cases about free enterprise and not about capitalism. Because capitalism at its core is, you know, about acquiring some asset, presumably money, but it doesn't necessarily have to be money, and then having that asset doing the work for you. And that's really a very different thing from free enterprise. I mean, if you, are you familiar with Dan Quinn's book, Ishmael?
No.
Andy, I strongly encourage you to read that book. I think you would find it fascinating. And
okay.
He makes the point in that book that in the very beginning, one of the first places where we went wrong, and where I would argue that you would say where we went right, was when somebody decided that they could lock up the food and they could keep it from everybody else. And suddenly, instead of, you know, the community all sharing the food resources because there was no way to lock it up, one person could lock it up and say, no, I've got all the food, you got to come to me. And in exchange for the food, you got to give me something. And we've simply substituted dollars for food. You think that's an inaccurate or accurate portrayal of the philosophical origins of capitalism?
Oh, no, I disagree. I mean, that's not the way I look at it. I think, again, to me, the essence here is the political principle of individual rights. And once an individual has rights, that means I could grow food, and it's mine. And then I could, you know, use it for myself and my family, or I can sell it to people who, in exchange for other goods and services that I need.
Grow it on what land, though?
Yeah, but I mean, the system of individual rights liberates the tremendously creative power of self-interest. It means people can then work hard and knowing that they're going to keep what they earn. And that's why one reason why, you know, the egoistic principle that is embodied in capitalism is one reason why it has a tremendous creation of wealth, because people know that they can keep what they've earned, what they've created, and they could exchange it with other creators, other producers, and that's why the standard of living just goes historically just skyrockets in the capitalist countries relative to the non-capitalist ones.
But what, for example, Marx pointed out in Das Kapital, and Quinn to some extent, although Quinn really doesn't talk about capitalism, you won't find the word capitalism in his book Ishmael, but again, I still encourage you to read it, is that you will end up in that kind of a situation. It's basically the monopoly game. You're going to end up in a situation where wealth becomes an instrument of increasing wealth, and you end up with robber barons. And in fact, throughout your book, you talk about the era that some people, you dismiss the phrase robber barons and prefer the phrase Gilded Age, that period from the 1870s to the, you know, 1910 or thereabouts. You view that as a high point of America.
Oh, absolutely. I think historians have completely missed the essence of it. They refer to it, following Mark Twain, they refer to it as the Gilded Age. I refer to it as the inventive period in honor of the tremendous outpouring of advances in applied technology. You know, Edison, Bell, the Wright brothers, Eastman, Westinghouse, et al., which are tremendously responsible for that productivity and the advances in inventiveness and innovativeness. That technology has enormously increased everybody's standard of living.
I agree with you, but I would say that was the Industrial Revolution. That didn't necessarily have anything to do with capitalism. That had to do with the development of technology. I mean, the 1880s, you saw almost 10,000 strikes and lockouts. In just the year 1886, 700,000 people went out on strike. In 1877, when the B&O Railroad cut wages, you know, you had strikes that spread nationwide. In Baltimore, the state militia killed 11 people. Andrew Carnegie's mentor, Thomas Scott, the Pennsylvania Railroad, the guy who helped Carnegie get going, he, in public, in print, he said, "Striker, anybody who strikes against a capitalist should be given," and I quote, "a rifle diet for a few days and see how they like that kind of bread," end quote. I mean, the average, actual, if you look at the average income of people during that period of time, it was quite low. People were not wealthy during, I mean, there was essentially no middle class.
Well, of course, I mean, but several points here. First of all, the Industrial Revolution that you're accurately referring to has everything to do with capitalism, because, again, the principle of individual rights not only liberates the people regarding the profit motive, and all of those guys, Edison, Bell, for instance, made millions of dollars.
Well, Edison actually screwed up a lot. I mean, he lost a lot of money because he wasn't a particularly good businessman.
Yeah, I know, he blew a lot of his money, but he earned plenty. And even when he retired, even after having blown so much of his money, I think his net worth was $12 million. But
that was only because he got a good business partner later on in his life. I mean, you know, after his competition with George Westinghouse. But I mean, look at this. In 1890, there were 12 million.
Let me respond to your point, because were poor. The when capitalism comes on the scene, both in Britain and in America, it inherits tremendous poverty from the earlier eras, and real wages rise all throughout the capitalist period, both in Britain and in America.
Well, I would suggest this had little to do with capitalism and a lot to do with the change from an agrarian-based society to an industrial-based society, because if you look at the United States pre-Civil War, you had the vast majority of people in this country were self-sufficient. In other words, they were living above a poverty level. They were able to provide for their own food and for their own needs. If you look at just the year 1890, for example, in 1890 there were 12 million families in the United States working, 12 million working people. Doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, that's what it was. 11 million of those people earned $1,200 a year or less. The average annual income was $380. Now, in today's dollars, if you were to extrapolate that out, that would be, you know, that $380 that was the average annual income was, depending on whose numbers you use, somewhere between $6,000 and $12,000 a year. I mean, people were living way below the poverty level. You had horrible poverty in the United States. This is why people who worked in Andrew Carnegie's mills, and you hold him up as this great, you know, hero, and I think, you know, some of his writings are great, and he left a great foundation, and I've always honored Andrew Carnegie for saying a man who dies rich is an immoral man, by the way. You know, he gave away so much of his money. But nonetheless, you know, people rioted against him.
Tom, again, I want to stress the poverty. I mean, you're right, and you're making, in a way, I think you're making my point. The poverty that exists in a pre-industrial agrarian society is exactly what held both in Britain and America when capitalism begins in the late 19th century here. I disagree. I think the Industrial Revolution is very much a product of capitalism because it liberates the great creative thinkers. The principle of individual rights means that the greatest minds don't have to bow and scrape before the aristocracy, the church, the Hitlers or the Stalins. They're now free to create new products, start their own companies, be entrepreneurial, make a lot of money.
But why is it then during that period of time, the Gilded Age that you like, that we had this enormous wealth and enormous poverty and virtually no middle class? And it wasn't until after the 1930s when government started interfering in capitalism and went from laissez-faire capitalism to regulated capitalism, then the middle class emerged.
Well, I don't agree. I think the only thing that can spread wealth across an entire economic system is rising real wages. And that's caused not by government intervention. It's caused by the production of exactly the productive geniuses that we're talking about, Carnegie, Rockefeller, Hill, Harriman, and now the government doesn't produce steel.
Well, they were all dead by the time the middle class started emerging.
Producers did that. That's what creates the wealth that we all take for granted in the capitalist country. Say the government didn't do that.
Well, that's what created the wealth for those few men. But that's not what created the wealth. I mean, you had, as I said, I mean, you had all across America, we were being racked by violent strikes and riots throughout that era.
It takes time to go from $300 per capita income to $30,000, which we have today. And the reason that we have that wealth today is because when you produce an enormous supply of goods, as industrial capitalism does, the prices come down and real wages rise. Wages measured in purchasing power rise. That's why we're wealthy, not because of the government, but because of the great producers like Carnegie, Rockefeller, Hill, and those guys.
Have you ever played Andrew Bernstein? Have you ever played Monopoly?
Sure.
What's the goal of the game?
To own all the property and bankrupt your competitors.
So everybody else is screwed, and you're the only one who wins. Isn't that what you're talking about?
That's not the real world, Tom. That's a game. In the real world, we're all wealthy because of the production of the great capitalists.
Okay, and you make a great argument for it in your book, The Capitalist Manifesto. Andy Bernstein, AYNRAND.org, and I'm assuming people can find the book in the usual
places. Yeah, on Amazon for sure.
Okay, great. Andy, good talking to you. 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We won't try to put us to death.
Talking about my generation.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. But small business interest. For example, our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, a small and locally owned company in Vermont. 1-800-511-MAX for all things Macintosh. 1-800-511-MACS or smalldog.com. Great company, been supporting this program for nearly 2 years, I think. Welcome back to our program. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. 866-440-THOM. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Tom, I love when you have these Ayn Rand guests on because, like you say, it does expose the true thinking because these guys are honest. And I love that you do this because that is what the conservative movement is thinking, but they'll never admit it because in a political democracy they would get clobbered.
That's the bottom line. Andy Bernstein is an honest and articulate guy, and he actually wrote a very good book. I recommend the book.
Yeah.
And he makes some good points in it. And I just think that there's a dividing line between free enterprise and capitalism. It needs to be a little more brightly delineated, and between laissez-faire capitalism and regulated capitalism. And that's the difference in opinion between he and I. I'm not claiming that I have an absolute lock on the truth, but let people make up their own minds.
What's obvious how they do this is that he's reinventing definition of words. He's defining capitalism as a system of governance. Webster's Dictionary describes it as an economic system.
Well, I would, he's not on the line right now, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I would suggest that what he's saying is that it enables a system of governance. And I would disagree with that. I would say, you know, the American democracy pre-existed the emergence of what he calls capitalism in the 19th century, because, you know, our country started in the 18th century. But yeah. Good point, Tom. And it's all about the words.
That's right. And the book Wealth and Democracy by Kevin Phillips talks about this conflating, and that's where the root of it all lies.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all, Tom, and you make your point very well. In fact, we ought to get Kevin Phillips on this program and have him talk about that, David. 1-866-440-8466, our phone number, Mike in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing today?
I am just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I was just calling. I caught a brief bit of your segment there with Mr. Bernstein.
Yeah.
And I think that, and I turned it off before you finished the conversation, so I'm not sure if you got here, but I think that you are both right in a little bit. He's right in that capitalism did indeed, spark invention and so forth in this country, but we wouldn't be where we are. There wouldn't be a middle class if it weren't for the kind of rise of labor and the intervention of government.
Yeah, that's my point. I mean, I'm not an anti-capitalist. I've started 7 businesses in my life. Although I guess that makes me a free enterprisist because I've never, just owned stock in a company, bought a company and just sat back and took passive profits from it, which is what a true capitalist would do. But I have, started businesses and run them. In fact, this radio show is a business. So here I am in the business world. Got no problem with that.
And I think the problem with libertarians is that they have this idea, and I'm not going to paint them with a broad brush, but they have this idea that you should just have absolutely no control over anything, and we've seen already what that could do.
Yeah.
No control, and, living here in Pittsburgh, I can tell you, the city was built on the fact that labor rose and there was intervention. We go back to look at Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, and at that point when we raised the awareness of the fact that people were working, in squalor, dying at their jobs. And if that hadn't happened, we wouldn't be where we are today. So.
Yeah, well said.
I just want to say, hey, thank you. I appreciate your program, and I listen to it daily. I run a blog here in Pittsburgh. You provide me with innumerable days' worth of...
Great. What's the blog like?
It's commentsfromleftfield.com. Commentsfromleftfield.com.
F-R-O-M, commentsfromleftfield.com.
Correct.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Thanks. I appreciate the call. Great to hear from you. Richard in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Mr. Bernstein made mention of Westinghouse and the Golden Age, but Westinghouse stole the technology from Nikola Tesla and left him penniless.
Yeah, well, you could argue that. I certainly would argue that, although Westinghouse wouldn't. He would say that Tesla was just a bad businessman, which is probably also true.
Yeah, but how can you link individual rights then with this capitalist idea?
Well, that's the problem, and that's where it gets into the this whole strange thing, and that is, you know, are we rewarding people for being slick businessmen? Is that the only value in society that we're going to hold and say that that's the one we're going to reward? Or do we really want to have a society where we're going to say, you know, somebody who's a good car mechanic has value, or somebody who works in a steel mill has value, or somebody who cleans the toilets in the school has value? I mean, at what point, you know, I think that there is, in some areas, this belief that a good capitalist is somehow a special class of person, and I don't subscribe to that.
Neither do I. I prefer your latter explanation.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
Yep, good to hear from you. I appreciate it. And Godfrey in West Orange, New Jersey. Hey, Godfrey, we have about a minute left. What's up? Godfrey, your telephone is breaking up here. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're on a cell phone and it's falling apart. Al, we're gonna go to Alan in Philadelphia. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
And just have a few seconds to go.
Hour a day with you is my brightest hour.
Well, thank you. You must be listening on Sirius Satellite Radio.
Yes, unfortunately, I wish it could be more than an hour.
Yeah, well, maybe one day it will.
I will definitely. I'll make my point to them about that. I'm segueing off of comments you made earlier and yesterday with regard to Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to put the lie to this notion that we're planting the seed of democracy so peace can flower in the Middle East. Because after all, Iran has a democratically elected parliament and president.
Right. They just have a Supreme Court that can. Right. They have a Supreme Court that can knock down any laws that are passed by their democratically elected parliament. And now, in the Constitution of Iraq, we seem to have duplicated the same thing. And good point. And time will tell. But I'm not very optimistic about this thing. But let us hope that everything works out well, because the future of much of the world depends on this. I mean, look at how World War I spread. Nobody could have predicted it. 2 minutes before the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination and clean elections here in the United States. Can we hope for clean elections in Iraq? Well, that's a whole other topic. Today, by the way, the 15th of December, today the day in 1791 that Virginia became the 10th out of 14 states to approve the first 10 of 12 amendments that were proposed to the Constitution of the United States. That collection of 10 amendments, now broadly known as the Bill of Rights. So the Bill of Rights, today the anniversary of it. Ironically, today the House, well, it was yesterday the vote, but it, you know, officially goes to the Senate today. The Patriot Act to eviscerate the Bill of Rights. It's just pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Pretty tragic in some ways. Speaking of laissez-faire capitalism, by the way, this is, you know, this just so highlights this. This is from USA Today today. DuPont has agreed to pay $10.25 million in fines. Now, that sounds like a lot of money. And $6.25 million more for environmental research and education to resolve federal charges, as Elizabeth Weiss writes in USA Today, to resolve federal charges that it hid information about the dangers posed by a chemical used to make Teflon and other products. Now, just, you know, imagine that. You know, I come over to your house and I walk around and spray something all over your house and don't tell you that it's actually going to cause cancer. And you ask me, what's that stuff you're spraying around the house? Oh, it's just improves the quality of the air. And then, you know, down the road you get sick and get cancer, and might you have some claws against me? Well, not if I'm a corporation, apparently, or at least not in a big way. We're talking about perfluoroctanoate phytic acid, or PFOA. It's used to make fluoropolymers, which is a class of chemicals that are stain-resistant and non-stick stuff, you know, the stuff that gets put onto, you know, sprayed onto Scotch Guard kind of stuff. I don't know if it's in Scotch Guard specifically. That's a brand name. But it's that, you know, the kind of thing that, prevents stains and the kind of thing that prevents, you know, sticking, right? Teflon. That we know. A science advisory board convened earlier this year by the Environmental Protection Agency found this stuff to be a likely carcinogen. So, now, here's the details of this violation. This is from the EPA report, right, from the Environmental Protection Agency. DuPont's violations were multiple I'm quoting from the report, were multiple failures to report information to the EPA about substantial risk of injury to human health or the environment that DuPont obtained about PFOA. That's the chemical. In other words, they knew something about this chemical, and they failed on multiple occasions to tell we, the people, our agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, that they knew something about this. For example, in 2001, they found that people who lived near their Washington Works facility, West Virginia, had PFOA in their bloodstreams. They didn't bother to tell anybody. In 1991, they withheld information about the contamination of public drinking water supplies near the same West Virginia plant. In 1981, they withheld findings that at least one pregnant worker at the plant had passed PFOA onto her fetus. And in 1997, they did a test on this stuff on the risk of inhaling PFOA and found that all of the rats tested died. Neglected to tell anybody about it. So the EPA could have fined them $300 million, which, again, I'd say for a company the size of Dow Chemical, or DuPont, excuse me, DuPont Chemical is a slap on the wrist. Instead, fined them $10.25 million. As Frank Mitch, a senior chemical analyst with Fulcrum Global Partners New York, pointed out, you know, this could have been $300 million. He says, while $300 million is a fine would have meant something to DuPont, $16 million is really just a rounding error to the chemical giant. And DuPont General Counsel, Stacey Mobley, their head lawyer, says that this allows the company to put the matter behind it and move forward. And I suppose to their credit, DuPont says that they are committed to cutting the emissions from the U.S. plant sites by 98% and by 99% by 2007. Why don't they just stop producing it right now? I mean, what's wrong with saying, no, you can't do it until you're not emitting any of this stuff? I mean, frankly, rather mind-boggling. I don't know how to put it beyond that. It's just, frankly, rather mind-boggling. George W. Bush, by the way, talking about the reasons why we invaded Iraq. George W. Bush in a conversation on December 4th, 2005.
Knowing what I know today, I would have still made that decision.
So if you had this, if the weapons had been out of the equation because the intelligence did not conclude that he had them, it was still the right call.
Yeah, absolutely. And
then on March 19th, 2003.
Our nation enters this conflict reluctantly. Yet our purpose is sure. The people of the United States and our friends and allies will not live at the mercy of an outlaw regime that threatens the peace with weapons of mass murder.
Bottom line. Hey, so here we have George W. Bush. This is from the thinkprogress.org blog. They said, we've got the video evidence. Here's George W. Bush on the one hand saying to Brit Hume, there were no weapons there, and but, you know, knowing what I know now, that there were no weapons, I still would have gone to war with them. But when he went to war with them, he told us that the only reason was, and he said there's, he said, he did not say purposes, he said there's only one purpose, this outlaw regime, weapons of mass destruction. this the place where I started with this whole thing. And it's just amazing to me how this is all, you know, spinning around. It's just, you know, just moving along. Bush able to transform the nature of this stuff. By the way, did you know that the United States ranks sixth among countries jailing journalists in the world? We've tied with the former country of Burma, now called Myanmar, for sixth place. This is from the New York Times. Among countries that are holding the most journalists behind bars. This is amazing. China topped the list. 32. They have 32 people in jail. 32. Number one, China. 32 journalists in jail. Many of them for activity in the internet. Seventh year in a row, by the way, they topped the list. And Cuba is second. They've got 24 journalists in jail. Eritrea third. Ethiopia fourth. Uzbekistan fifth. The United States of America sixth. And we're supposed to be fostering democracy. We're number six in terms of journalists in prison. We're holding four Iraqi journalists in detention centers in Iraq, one Sudanese, a cameraman who works for Al Jazeera at a naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. None of the journalists that we are holding has been charged with a crime. Not one. But at least the Chinese charge them with crimes, right? The most common crime is writing critically about the Communist Party online. You write something bad about the Communist Party in China, and, you know, they arrest you, and they say, you wrote something bad about the Communist Party. And people go, oh, well, yeah, I guess I knew that was a crime. Off I go. But here now, we have all these folks in prison. No reason for it. No reason that we're telling people. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. John in Greenberg, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, what's up? We got about a minute left here before we got to take a break, but I believe you're on the line there.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, with regards to the DuPont matter, you're forgetting that according to objectivist economic theory, there's no need for government penalties because the company will lose its reputation among consumers.
Right. Yeah, they did. Absolutely, right? None of us are ever going to buy DuPont again. Come on. Yeah.
I actually called about your interview in the last hour. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed that you're a widely traveled man, I am not, that in societies where people actually have to live under laissez-faire capitalism, under oligarchies, such as in Hong Kong, there's no real market for books like your guests advocating laissez-faire capitalism?
Well, that's interesting. I've never noticed. I've never looked. But what I can tell you is that there's not much of a middle class in those kind of countries.
Exactly. And people there know what it is to actually exist under those conditions.
Yeah, there you go.
We don't.
There you go. Well said, John. Well, actually, we did in the United States at one time. We have forgotten. And that's the great lessons of the Gilded Age have been so forgotten by people in the United States. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It was a slow day, and the sun was beating on the soldiers by the side of the road.
Welcome back.
A shattering of shop windows, the bomb in the baby carriage was wired to the radio. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the long, this is gone.
Indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour on the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Ellen Ratner with us with Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., deep in the belly of the beast. Hey, Ellen, how's your eye doing?
Well, it's not doing well. I need a third surgery tomorrow, and there's only a 50-50 chance I'll keep my vision. But so next week you'll have my various staff people, and I think Michael Harrison's going to join you one day.
That would be marvelous. That would be marvelous. So, and I wish you the very best in your surgery, and I hope that all of our listeners will also, you know, hold you in whatever the appropriate belief model they may have of their prayers or their light or whatever for your surgery.
Just remember, it's in my right eye, not, fortunately, my left.
Okay. Yeah.
In any case, the White House is now just touting the Iraqi vote, saying that they're hearing that there was a 67% voting margin, and they're totally undermining any possibility of a lot of violence. There have been a couple of people killed, we know, and of course another Marine was killed yesterday in Ramadi. But they're saying that this is a victory for democracy. Now, you and I know, as several members of the Democrats, our services committee, et cetera, have said, we want to see benchmarks. We want to see real progress.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that apparently rumor has it that Bush and McCain are close to a deal as a face saver for Bush on the treatment over prisoners. We'll see what the deal is. It may be announced as late as today.
Right, because Bush is going to lose in Congress. I mean, they're preparing
time
to kick his butt on this one.
So now he has to come out like he's been negotiating this and he's a winner.
Yeah, or he's been in favor of it all along. I mean, that kind of thing.
The White House also said today that Robert Novak was not correct on this leaked identity and that the president knew about this. He said, I don't know what Novak is basing this on.
So when Bush said...
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official... Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
That he was speaking the truth?
We have no idea. I mean, the White House is obviously trying to put the dogs off the sniffing track.
Yeah.
Pelosi now wants Congress to stay in session until she says that some of their priorities, have been met, particularly around the prescription drug benefit and the Hurricane Katrina survivors. Now, one of the things I said to you earlier today is that the president sort of tried to stack the White House Conference on Aging with his people.
Mm-hmm.
And despite that, even though they sat on the stage with their arms folded yesterday, people from red states and blue states actually wound up voting against trying to modify Social Security and also voted against trying to cut funds for training geriatrics and also voted against the prescription drug plan as it currently exists.
Well, this was Bush's handpicked people?
Well, no. The White House Conference on Aging is it's in the statute. Every 10 years has to have a White House Conference on Aging.
Right.
And it's interesting. Neither Mrs. Bush nor the President nor the Vice President nor Mrs. Cheney nor even the older Mrs. Bush actually showed up at this conference. Then Congress members and the governors, et cetera, pick delegates. And then the Bush people get to pick some delegates.
I see.
But even though they tried to stack the delegation, it did not work. Their proposals got voted down.
Yeah. I think the reality of what's happening here, Ellen, is that people are realizing that, you know, when Ronald Reagan talked about trickle-down economics and supply-side economics, everybody and George Herbert Walker Bush called it voodoo economics and said it was dangerous and it would destroy America. You know, a lot of people thought, well, you know, it's just Reagan talking out of the top of his hat. These are just, you know, they want to make the rich people a little richer, but it's not going to hurt us or anything. And I think people are realizing now, after 25 years of Reaganomics and trickle-down economics and insane trade policies, that it actually is hurting us.
Well, I would hope people realize that. One last thing. John Thune, as you know, the man who beat Tom Daschle, we think, maybe.
Yeah.
Now apparently going to be having a greater hand in Republican messaging. Keep the eye on the birdie, as I always say. Watch what they're doing with Thune.
Yeah, okay. So John Thune is going to become the new spokes-toady?
That's right.
Okay, great. Ellen Ratner, good talking with you. Good luck on your surgery, Ellen.
And I will talk to you right after the new year.
Okay, great.
Thanks.
Good. Do good. Be well. Take good care of yourself. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America and the rest of the planet as well.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you understand the thing I'm feeling today? The button's pushed, there's no running away. No one's safe with the world in the gray. Take a look around you, boy. It's time to stand before you.
Tell me over and over and over again, my friend.
Well, it's not the original version, but it's close. Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Ken Lay, not keeping quiet here. It's from CBS. In fact, tip of the hat to the folks in the chat room for passing this along. If you want to drop into our chat room, by the way, go to TomHartman.com and just click the live chat button, and you can find out what is all that live chat stuff about. You mean there's real people in real time? If I type something, somebody else can get it. I can even talk to people in private. Yes. Anyhow, TomHartman.com, click live chat. It'll get you over there. And you'll find I'm there, David's there, Alex and Dan are there, folks. All of us were there. Anyhow, Enron Corp founder Ken Lay launched an impassioned plea for former employees of the bankrupt energy company to defy a wave of terror by federal prosecutors and help him battle criminal charges. You get this? Ken Lay is asking his former employees. Now, I mean, imagine what you're one of the people who used to work for Enron who saw your entire life savings tank. And if you haven't seen the movie The Smartest Guys in the Room, I believe that's the title of it, the movie about Enron, you know, from Run Don't Walk to where your nearest video rental place. Anyway, so here's Ken Lay asking the former employees of Enron to help keep him from being prosecuted. He says it will only take a few brave individuals who are willing to stand up and say it's time for the truth to come out. This is what he told a Houston forum a month before he faces trial on fraud and conspiracy counts. Lay reiterated, isn't that interesting? Lay, you got Ken Lay and Tom D. Lay, and, you know, interesting. Anyway, Lay reiterated in a speech Tuesday before about 500 business and academic leaders his insistence that he committed no crimes related to Enron's 2001 crash, accused the government of bullying potential witnesses who could help him, and promised to testify in his own defense. He quoted Winston Churchill. He says, "Truth is a great rock. Whether it will continue to be submerged by a wave of terror by the Enron task force, will be determined by former Enron employees." Yeah. A wave of terror. CBS reporting Tom DeLay, or Ken Lay, is concerned about. By the way, the Pentagon spied on Americans. NBC News obtained the secret database. It's been in the news for a couple of days. I would like to take a little deeper look at that, and we'll do that in just a second. First, though, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. Lewis in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Lewis, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Your remarks about Ken Lay and corporate crime remind me, as a law professor, of one of the biggest flaws behind the argument of laissez-faire proponents on libertarianism.
Laissez-faire capitalism. We should probably explain to people, they hear laissez-faire and they don't understand what it means. It's French for without limits or restraint, is it not?
Yes, it is. My point is, basically, there's never been such a thing as laissez-faire. The United States has rules, and I teach those rules in class, torts, contracts, rules about injuries, rules about employment, relationships. These rules are prior to all legislation in this country. They're common law rules, and they form the government by stealth, as I call it to my students, that constructs the market, that allows the market to proceed. And in the 19th century in particular, there were substantial changes in those background rules that tended to hurt employees and consumers.
Yeah, and in fact, Lewis,
essentially subsidies to corporate interests. And what gets me is it seems as if the laissez-faire proponents imagine that these individual rights that they tout drop from heaven. They don't. They are there precisely because of stealth government. And
stealth in a good sense.
And when legislatures intervene in the marketplace, it's more visible, I understand. But basically what they're doing is it's one branch of government changing what another branch of government says the fundamental rules of the game are.
Yeah. But, yeah, it, well said. And the reality is that there is no such thing as a free marketplace, with the exception of neighbors bartering with each other.
Yes, I agree with that. Primitive economies where there's essentially no government, anarchic government, lack of government.
Although there's a lot of government because there are rituals, traditions, customs.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, you read, for example, Peter Farb's book, Man's Rise to Civilization and the Native and the American Indian, which came out in 1965. It's a politically incorrect title, but in fact, I'm not even sure it's still in print. But it's the best ethnography of Native American communities across the United States pre-contact. And they were very sophisticated societies, rules of one of the quotes from Peter Farb's book that I quoted in my book Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, where he was talking about the Shoshone, who were hunter gatherers in the Southwest, who literally did not even create villages, and he said yet they had rules of etiquette that were every bit as detailed and elaborate as the court at Versailles.
Exactly. In fact, one of our great legal scholars, Carl Llewellyn, did a study of the Cheyenne Indian tribe and wrote a book called The Cheyenne Way together with an anthropologist of law. And it's a record of their, quote, legal system, close quote, you know, even though they didn't have writing and books.
Yeah, so the bottom line is that there really is no such thing as a laissez-faire, that is a totally unrestrained capitalist or trade system. And even, I mean, all this whole thing of free trade is silly. I mean, the WTO agreements would fill, you know, it printed out in paper, they'd fill the studio I'm sitting in, which is probably 15 by 15 feet square. I mean, it's hundreds of thousands of sheets of paper.
Yes, exactly. Without government, you cannot have markets in the modern sense of the word. And so it's a question of which kind of market you want, not whether the market is regulated or unregulated, because all markets are by definition regulated.
Right, and to whose benefit that market operates.
Exactly.
Well said, Lewis. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I also wrote a book about this called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And when I was writing this book, it started out, I started out as writing a book about Jefferson because, and ultimately later I finished writing the book about Jefferson called What Would Jefferson Do? But I'd come across a complete collection of Jefferson's writings published in 1904, the only time it's ever been published, all 20 volumes of his stuff. And I lived inside Jefferson's head for a couple of years. And so I was writing this kind of history of Jeffersonian democracy. And as I'm going through the arc of how, you know, from the Boston Tea Party, what Jefferson referred to as that little incident in Boston Harbor that really changed his mind. I mean, he had published in early 1773, he had published A Summary View of the Rights of British Americans. In other words, it was a book about how to be a good citizen of Great Britain living on the North American continent. He had gone from that in the summer of 1773 to in the December of 1773, right after the Boston Tea Party, being in favor of our separation from England. And it was that Boston Tea Party was one of these turning points for Jefferson and for many of the founders, and it was a rebellion against a multinational corporation, the British East India Company. And so we had built into our laws from the founding of this country up until 1886, by and large, up until the Gilded Age, all these protections. If you wanted to start a corporation, you could only do one thing with that corporation. The corporation had a limited lifetime. It could only last as long as the productive life of a human being. It varied from state to state, but 20, 30, or 40 years was the range. It was every year it had to be reexamined by the Secretary of State. It required actually an act of the legislature of the state in which it was incorporated. At the beginning of the Civil War in the 1860s, there were only 2,000 corporations in America. On average, over 100 corporations in the 1850s a year were given the death sentence for failing to fulfill their corporate mandate. The first reason that you were incorporated had to be to serve the public good. I mean, there were all these oversights and all these protections. And so I'm writing this book, and as I'm going along writing the book, and I get to this barrier in the Gilded Age in the 1880s where all of a sudden corporations are no longer restrained by we the people. And in fact, there had been this fascinating correspondence back in the 1700s, in 1787, between Jefferson and Madison. Madison sent Jefferson a copy of the first draft of the Constitution. Madison was running the Constitutional Convention in 1787. Well, he wasn't running it, but he, for all practical purposes, he was running it. And And he's called the father of the Constitution. And Jefferson was the U.S. envoy to France. He was in Paris. And so Madison sends him off this copy, and Jefferson sends it back saying, well, this is all well and good, but here's what I don't like about it. There's no Bill of Rights in here. Today, by the way, the anniversary of the ratification of the Bill of Rights. And so Jefferson and Madison get into this long discussion in mail, you know, about this, and we've talked about this on the program before about, you know, future generations and does government give rights and things like that. But one of the points that Jefferson made, he had 10 things that he wanted to be in a Bill of Rights, and one of them was a ban on monopolies in commerce, quote unquote. And he absolutely wanted these constraints on corporations so that there would never again arise in the United States an equivalent of the British East India Company, a corporation that was so big that it could influence government, the way that the British East India Company had the British government doing its bidding for it. And Madison's response to him was, we don't have to worry about that because the word corporation doesn't even exist in the Constitution. Corporations are not created at the federal level. They're created at the state level, and all the states have rules like that. And Jefferson finally gave in. So how did it change? So I'm going through these history books, and all the history books I'm reading say in 1886 there was a Supreme Court decision that said that corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment, and therefore they have the rights of, you know, in the Bill of Rights that all the rest of us have, and therefore, you know, all those protections, all those limits on them have to be thrown out the window. And I got to tell you the most amazing story about the discovery of the non-discovery. So I'll do it right after the break. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back,
my
friends.
Daddy didn't like trouble, but if it came along, everyone that knew him knew which side that he'd be on. He never was a hero for this county's shining light, but you could always find him standing up for what he thought was right. He'd say, you've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything.
There you go, my friends.
You've got to be your own man, not a puppet on the screen.
Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Now, here, for example, I got to just, this is, pardon the digression, but this is really important stuff. This is an example of the laws that were in every state in the United States. This is from an old Wisconsin statute. Law in Wisconsin, but there were similar laws in every other state. This just happens to be the Wisconsin law, and these were on the books. This one actually wasn't repealed until the 1950s, as I recall. Sort of, it got accidentally left on the books. Excuse me. Political contributions by corporations. That's the title of it. No corporation doing business in this state shall pay or contribute, or offer consent or agree to pay or contribute, directly or indirectly, any money, property, free service of its officers or individuals, or thing of value to any political party, organization, committee, or individual for any political purpose whatsoever, or for the purpose of influencing legislation of any kind, or to promote or defeat the candidacy of any person for nomination, appointment, or election to any political office. Penalty. Any officer, employee, agent, attorney, or other representative of any corporation acting for and in behalf of such corporation who shall violate this act shall be punished upon conviction by a fine of not less than $100 nor more than $5,000. Now, back in the 19th century, that was a lot of money. Or by imprisonment in the state prison for a period of not less than 1 nor more than 5 years, or both. If it is a domestic corporation, it shall be dissolved if, after a proper proceeding upon quo warranto in either the circuit or Supreme Court of the state to be prosecuted, the state shall find the judgment, the bloody, bloody, blah. And if a foreign or non-resident corporation, its right to do business in this state is declared forfeit. Now, why don't we have laws like that any longer? Why is it that Nike argued before the Supreme Court year before last that they had the First Amendment right to lie to people? because you and I have the First Amendment right, because I can, you know, I can say to my wife, you know, you look beautiful in that dress, if I don't think that she does, although usually I do, Louise, if you're listening. But you get it. I mean, there's no law against lying unless you're talking to a police officer, an officer of the court, or you're under oath. Why is it, you know, so a corporation, you know, Nike argued, why is it that Dow Chemical argued successfully that they had the Fourth Amendment before the Supreme Court, that they have a Fourth Amendment right to privacy, and therefore the EPA can't pull surprise inspections on them? Why is it that JCPenney back in 1936 argued successfully before the Supreme Court that under the 14th Amendment, if the state of Florida had out-of-state, what you might call predatory, what I would call predatory corporations, coming into the state and competing with small local businesses, that those out-of-state companies had to pay higher taxes? And they said that's the same thing as saying that if somebody's a different color, they can't sit at the same lunch counter. Now, this was in 1936 when there were laws, legal segregation in the United States, and still JCPenney won. Why is it that corporations, tobacco companies, asbestos companies were able for decades, for generations, to hide the toxicity of their products by claiming Fifth Amendment rights to not incriminate themselves and Fourth Amendment rights of privacy? Why is it that that's possible? Because it wasn't possible before 1886. Well, what I read in all these history books was that in 1886, the Supreme Court ruled in a case called Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad that the 14th Amendment, which was put into place along with the 13th and 15th Amendments after the Civil War to free the slaves in the 1870s, that the 14th Amendment, which says no person shall be denied equal protection under the law, in other words, no matter what color you are, the law applies to you equally, that the railroad argued that they were a person and that the Supreme Court thus ruled. And in fact, in a series of cases since then, the Supreme Court has even quoted that. For example, Rehnquist in his dissent in First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti starts right out by saying, you know, back in 1886, the Supreme Court ruled, you know. Well, so anyhow, I go down to I was living in Montpelier, Vermont. I go down to the law library and say, you know, I'd like to read this case, this 1886 Santa Clara County case. So the Paul Donovan, the librarian there, he finds the old book, you know, the original leather-bound, published in 1889, pulls it off the shelf, blows off the dust. I read the case. It's like 22 pages long of 19th-century legalese. Nowhere in the case does it say that. In fact, it says the opposite. At the end, it says, because there was not a constant, you know, because we were able to decide this based on California law, we didn't have to deal with the federal constitutional issues that were raised by the plaintiffs. So I'm like, what happened? And then, and so I asked Paul, you know, what's the deal? He says, read the headnote. The headnote is this little commentary in the front of the case. The headnote starts out, corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment and entitled to equal protection under the law. Now, the headnote has no legal standing. It turns out the headnote was written by a man named John Chandler Bancroft Davis, who was the former president of the Newburgh and New York Railroad, who was the son of the former governor of New York, wealthy, elite, you know, wealth and power. And he put these words in the mouth of the Supreme Court Chief Justice, who died before Bancroft published them 2 years later. And based on this deception in 1886, we have now corporations taking over, as you know, using the power of the Bill of Rights. Today is its anniversary. Using the power of the Bill of Rights, this giant club that we were given by the founders to beat back government should it ever become oppressive, corporations using that. Anyway, I lay out the whole story in my book on equal protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And there's other books about, you know, this out there as well. But thought you'd want to know. It's all a scam. It's not what the founders intended at all. And really, you know, we ought to wake a few folks up about it and say, let's go back to the days when the corporations were the servants of the people rather than masters. To paraphrase Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican president, who said, you know, we have no problem with small business. We encourage medium-sized business. But with big business, it's an entirely different issue. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the place where tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. It's just not, well, yeah, I shouldn't tell Jeff Gannon jokes. It's just, it's, you know, it's too easy, I guess. Anyhow, the place where being progressive never felt so good. Welcome back to our program. Mark Crispin Miller is with us. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I am just great. Great to have you on and hear from you. How's the book doing, by the way?
The book's doing well. I mean, you know, the grassroots response is excellent. I was just at an event here in the city last night with Bob Fitrakis and Steve Freeman and Bo Lipari. True Majority sponsored it. It was terrific.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It's still kind of a press blackout on the book, but I think Fooled Again will ultimately prevail.
That's the thing that amazes me, your new book, Fooled Again. I'm sorry, I don't have the book in front of me, and the subtitle is long enough that I don't remember the whole thing. You give it to us.
Yeah, it's how the right stole the 2004 election and why they'll steal the next one, too, unless we stop them.
Unless we stop them. That last part is the part that I like the best.
That's true. Without that, it's kind of depressing.
Yeah, and Mark, for our listeners, you've been on the program before, but for those who haven't heard you, you're also a professor of culture and communications at New York University, and this is not your only book. In fact, I think one of your book, The Bush Dyslexicon, is that the title? When I was first exposed to your work, and your analysis of George Bush's use of language and that insight into his thinking processes was perhaps one of the most chilling experiences, in my early discovering about George W. Bush.
Yeah, well.
And that book is still a good read.
Well, thank you. I'm reading your book now, and I think it's terrific.
Which one?
The new one, Ultimate Sacrifice.
Ah, oh, thank you.
Oh, really? It's just riveting. I can't recommend it. Okay. There's a little log rolling going on here, but
yeah, there you go.
It's okay. Important. It's, your book's important because it lays to rest so much fevered propaganda mythology about the Kennedy assassination.
Well, and also it characterizes John and Robert Kennedy as really the good liberals that they were to a large. I mean, they were. It depends on what your definitions are, but I mean, these were guys who really believed in public service, who really believed in the public good, who really believed the government could be a tool for good, who really believed in their country. And today's modern conservatives believe in none of that.
That's right. Well, the difference is staggering.
Yeah, and we wanted to draw that picture as well. Anyhow, the reason I wanted to speak with you is following up on your book Fooled Again and what's going on with voting machines out there. I've been getting emails from you periodically and been seeing stuff in the blogosphere.
Yeah.
Not much in the mainstream media, unfortunately. Yeah. But what's up? Tell us about the two things that I'm most curious about are, I understand that some Diebold machines were successfully hacked down in Florida in a demonstration, number one. And number two, that Wally O'Dell, the head of Diebold, has hung his hat up.
That's right. Diebold is in big trouble. Now, I say this first with some trepidation, because I don't want people to feel a false sense of comfort. The fact that one of the large private vendors that manufactures electronic voting machines is in trouble is gratifying, and it's also revealing, but we got to be careful not to start popping the champagne corks right away, because the problem isn't this one company. The problem is all these private vendors. And the
problem is that we've privatized our vote.
Exactly.
We've outsourced our vote.
Privatized voting. These machines have no place in any kind of in any real democracy, because using them is tantamount to having a secret vote count. But people should know that Diebold, is a pretty shady operation. There's a securities fraud class action suit that's been filed against them. Wally O'Dell, the CEO, has stepped down. He's the one who became notorious for sending around a fundraising letter to Ohio Republicans last fall before Election Day, asking for money for Bush Cheney and pledging his personal commitment to delivering Ohio's electoral vote to the president. This guy's the CEO of a company that makes voting machines. Now, he's resigned. There's a lot of rumors today that Diebold is facing bankruptcy. There's people suggesting short selling for your listeners who are financially savvy. That might be worth looking into.
Yeah, buy Diebold puts. But Diebold, but voting machines is just a small part of their business.
That's right.
Most ATMs are Diebold.
That's right. It's a small and not that profitable part of their business. It does pretty well off of government money, allotted through the Help America Vote Act.
Yeah, have a allocated, what, $4 billion to give to voting machine companies? Yeah.
That's not where the struggle lies. Struggle doesn't really lie in bankruptcy courts, although any way to bring these entities down is fine with me. But the principle here is to salvage or even to realize the promise of American democracy, and that means not just voting, but having control, popular control of elections, and elections that are completely transparent. We have nothing like that now. Now, Help America Vote Act has a deadline of January 1st for states to choose their voting systems.
January 1st of?
This coming January 1st. I mean, it's upon us.
2006.
Now, if we had a free and independent press in the United States, which was once, I think, a very good idea that the framers had, we would know what's going on nationwide. The fact is only crackpots like you and I know what's going on because we were hunched over the computer keyboard all day long. The fact is that all over the country there's a big push to force the likes of Diebold down the throats of American citizens. In Bucks County, Pennsylvania, there's going to be an attempt to force Diebold onto the counties there. With onto the voters there, even though there's a very spirited grassroots resistance movement. Anyone who's interested should check out the Coalition for Voting Integrity .org. It's run by a very feisty woman named Mary Ann Gould, who has vowed not to let this happen in Bucks County. In North Carolina, this is an interesting story. A judge refused to give Diebold a waiver. You know, by law in North Carolina, all these companies have to put their programming codes in escrow so that they can be analyzed by the public. Diebold asked for a waiver. They did not want to put their programming code in escrow.
Well, they have never publicly disclosed
their programming code.
In fact, none of these companies have, have they?
That's exactly right. That's just one more reason why we ought not to trust them. Well, a judge in North Carolina refused to give them the waiver. They then said they were going to pull out of the state. And what do you know? Like a couple of days later, the Board of Elections in North Carolina approved Diebold for use in North Carolina.
This is independent of the waiver issue.
Despite that. It's illegal. This is John Edwards' state. I've been contacting his office, hoping for a meeting with him, because I think he should speak out on this. But here again, there is a very spirited grassroots effort to stop it. It's called NC Voter. It's at ncvoter.net, and the woman in charge of that operation is named Joyce McCloy. There really ought to be a national organization, an umbrella for all these different state groups, and that probably will come once people like George Soros cough up some money to help with this movement.
Or if an organization like the League of Women Voters that has a long, relatively nonpartisan and respected position were to jump into the fray here.
Well, the League of Women Voters actually stands alone. I don't know where Common Cause is. There's a whole lot of groups. I don't know where they are. But the League of Women Voters has actually been quite good lately, and it's the only such national organization that's really working hard on this issue. It's taken a front row position.
Mm-hmm.
But this stuff's going on, all over. There's a move in Illinois to get the machines used there. There's a move here in New York to get the machines moved here. You know, it's not too difficult to figure out what's happening. This stuff is, closely linked up with all the various other ways in which the Republicans are trying to subvert American democracy by, many, many different ways to cut the Democratic vote down to the size of a permanent minority. But places like New York, like Illinois, like Pennsylvania, and indeed even North Carolina are historically Democratic. So the purpose is quite clear here. It's to take Democratic strongholds and to break them so that they can't really resist the Bush Republican juggernaut This is very, very serious, and that's why people have to wake up to what's going on and freak out over it. People's hair should be on fire because our democracy is at risk, and it's not only our troops who have the obligation to protect it.
Yeah, well said. We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller. Mark, can you stick around?
Yeah.
I would like to get into what happened in Florida with you. I'd like to talk to you about what's going on in California. I'm assuming you have something to say about both those issues?
I have a little bit to say, yeah.
Okay, great. We'll come back on that. We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller, professor of culture and communications at New York University, author of Fooled Again. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Iraq is the front in the war against terror. Might be because we invited a mayor. Perhaps there's some terrible clerical error. Maybe a faulty equation. Like 911 equals U.S. invasion.
It's the hour, the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC. We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller, professor of culture and communications at New York University and the author of numerous brilliant books, including the most recent, which you must go out and buy right now and read to all your friends out loud, called Fooled Again. And the subtitle, Mark, is...
How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, Too, Unless We Stop Them.
Now.
Yeah, like yesterday weekend.
There you go. Leon County, Florida. Tell me what happened in Leon County, Florida.
Well, yeah, they had a hacking demonstration down there. I don't mean they all got together and coughed.
Right.
They had a computer hacker do a kind of demonstration break-in on a Diebold machine to show how easy it is.
Now, who organized this?
I believe it was Black Box Voting.
So this wasn't the voting machine company, and it wasn't the county trying to prove how invincible they were. This was
Bev Harris, a longtime activist on
sure.
this issue.
Yeah.
Blackboxvoting.org. People could check her site out.
Yeah, it's a great site. Bev's a good friend.
Right. And she, you know, did a really successful thing here. They managed to show that Diebold's machines are not trustworthy, as if we needed further evidence. But this was a dramatic way to demonstrate it. And the Leon County Board of Elections supervisor has said that Diebold will never be used in Leon County again.
Yeah, my understanding is that what happened was they had a machine set up, and the vote was, is Diebold secure or not, yes or no? And they had eight people who were voting, and they knew that six of them were going to vote yes, it's secure, because they were the local folks, you know, the Leon County folks. And then there were these two hackers who were going to vote no. And everybody pushed their votes, and in fact, everybody got to watch everybody else vote. It wasn't a secret vote. And then they pushed the tabulate button, and when it was all finished, it came back that there were seven yes votes and only one no vote. When, in fact, they had all watched there being six yes votes and two no votes.
Yeah, well, it's kind of hard to argue with that, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and they're standing there with their mouths open going, how'd you do that?
Yeah. Well,
how'd you do that?
This actually has something to do with people's current legal troubles, because some of the class action suit involves this kind of, failure to come across with the real weaknesses of the system. I mean, they're definitely in trouble. They're definitely on the run. But, again, you know, I don't know if we've talked about this before, but down in Venezuela, there was a boycott by several conservative parties who oppose Hugo Chavez's government because the government had set up this new account with a machine company called Smartmatic, which now owns Sequoia. But
which, by the way, counts a lot of the votes here in Oregon.
Exactly. Sequoia is used all over the United States.
And it's a Venezuelan company.
It's now a Venezuelan company. But the point is, I am no happier about Hugo Chavez using that machine than I am about the Bush people using them up here.
Well, this raises an interesting question, Mark. Finish your thought.
I was going to say, whenever a Republican, a Bush Republican, tries to shoot you down by saying you're paranoid about the machines, just say, well, do you trust the machines in Venezuela? Do you trust the machines that a far-left populist president is using to make sure he stays in power, they'll be singing another tune in that case, you see. So I think that it's actually a useful fact that someone on the left is relying on these machines. I don't think that they should be using them there either.
Well, this is the thing that really gets me. The only politician in the United States who has ever on national television, on live national television in 90 seconds, act into a Diebold central tabulator system and altered the output of an election and done it in real time on TV is Howard Dean.
Exactly.
And he did that on Tina Brown's Topic A with Tina Brown show on CNBC when he guest hosted for her. He didn't actually, I mean, he actually did it, but Bev Harris sat next to him and walked him through it. But he hacked a Diebold machine, altered an election in an untraceable way in 90 seconds.
Right.
And how can the Republicans refuse to allow, for example, Rush Holt's bill or any kind of legislation that would have that would place some controls on these machines? Or, you know, in my opinion, I mean, we should say altogether, you know, the software has to be open source. This is you know, it's we the people, but that's a whole other thing. How can the Republican? What are they? Do they really think that they're going to control this government forever?
Well, that's what they think. Don't forget that for the most extreme of them, Tom, you know this very well. Forever isn't that long a time. I mean, as far as they're concerned, the rapture will come all that much sooner. The more power they get and the more quickly they destroy the Earth's resources and bring about Armageddon in the Middle East. I mean, they've got a really crazy worldview. It's
yeah.
Something that most
And you know, you tell that to people and they look at you like you're from Mars. But, Mark, there are serious people in this administration, including the President of the United States, who actually believe that.
Absolutely believe it. And as far as Dean is concerned, you know, how can the Republicans refuse to pass this legislation? But by the same token, how is it that Howard Dean has clammed up on this issue since he took over the DNC? I urge your listeners.
I had him on my program, and he came, you know, I said, you hacked this machine, and he said, yeah, we got to do something about these.
Well, what does he plan to do? Anything?
Well, he was supporting Rush. I believe he was supporting Rush Holt's legislation. I had to go back and listen to the transcript. It's been a while.
Oh, I think everybody who's listening should call the DNC and say, you're not getting a dime from me.
There you go. And I also asked Howard Dean. I said, don't you think that it's wrong to privatize the vote? And he said, yes, I think it's wrong to privatize the vote. He was explicit about that. Mark Crispin Miller, Fooled Again, the book. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone. Welcome back to our program, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, however you want to spell it. We'll get you to our webpage. You click on live chat, and it'll drop you into our live chat room. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom. Tied right in having Mark Crispin Miller on. What a brilliant guy.
He is. He's really...
One thing that wasn't mentioned as you were talking with him, ProjectCensored.org has as one of their top 2006 censored stories, No Paper Trail Left Behind, the Theft of the 2004 Presidential Election. It's a good overview.
Yeah, and in fact, I won a Project Censored Award 4 years ago for the first article that was written about this stuff, in which I talked about Bev Harris and all that stuff. So,
right.
And that's in the Project Censored 2003 book.
The reason that I called two things. One, to kind of bring you up to date on what's going on in New Mexico, but and hopefully maybe motivate some folks to get involved with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm peripherally involved with election reform in New Mexico. I'm not one of the movers and shakers. I write the letters when they tell me to. I show up when they tell me to. Yesterday, the election reform task force had their final hearing up in Santa Fe to refine the revised new state law that was passed in the last legislature.
Is this a governmental body that is created to comply with HAVA?
No, actually it was created by the legislature just to improve what the work that the legislature did last year when they set up the state election reform.
I see.
HAVA does fall into it to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
The thing was that was what was good was we didn't get everything we wanted, but we didn't get anything that we didn't want.
That's great. And so you show up and participate, and you can make some changes.
And more importantly, with the folks that were involved in working with some of the legislatures, the legislators that were on the panel, the first item of business yesterday was to get the panel extended for another year so that we can continue the work that we've been doing. And it was cleaning up things to where we have a voter verifiable paper ballot.
There you go.
Legally.
Yeah.
The Sequoia machines, getting rid of the touchscreen machines, all of those kinds of things.
Or step two, simply saying.
The process hasn't finished.
Yeah.
But we've made such good headway, and hopefully we're getting some headlines and we're getting some people involved.
Yeah.
But it has to get out there, this whole story of these people stealing the votes.
Well, it's even bigger than that, Roy. I mean, even if the machines were complete, you know, had total integrity and could not be hacked and everything was, you know, perfect exactly the way they say, it still is not the way that democracy is supposed to work. The whole concept of government in a democratic republic like the United States is that we the people tell our government, our elected officials, we elect representatives to administer the commons, to run our country for us, to run our police departments and our fire departments and our roads and our schools and so on and so forth. And that is the commons. The government itself is part of the commons, and the most sacred part of that commons is the vote. And
right.
The commons should not be privatized. It should be held in trust as the property of we the people. And therefore, the vote should never be privatized. And with these electronic voting machine companies saying that they will count our votes in secret on proprietary software and not tell us how that software is written and not allow us to see the process and then tell us after the fact how we voted, that not only have they privatized our vote, but, you know, as you say, there's the potential for fraud. But even if there was no fraud, that's not how democracy is supposed to work.
That was the thing came up yesterday of what these companies were doing and whatnot. And it was, hey, wait a second. We've got universities in New Mexico. Let's do it. Let them program it. Let them design this.
Make it open source, you know, Wikipedia.
Right there, we're all on that, but. It just has to get out there, and hopefully, I'm hoping that this class action Debo lawsuit will at least ratchet up some spotlight on it.
Yeah.
At least put a crack of daylight into it.
Yep, agreed.
So
agreed, and well said.
It'll be a good jumping off point for lots of discussion.
There you
go.
I hope so too.
You just got to get out there and just keep on raising hell.
There you go. And Roy, I want to salute you one more time for doing it on an ongoing basis.
There's a lot of them doing a lot more work than I am.
Yeah, but you're out
to what they want me to do.
And you're out there, too, and I thank you for it. Good talking to you, Roy. Keith in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You're doing a great job. Listen, I just called the Washington State League of Women Voters. I was curious to what you're talking about, the
mm-hmm.
women voters in some states, and I got kind of a hostile response. No, I didn't talk to the director. It was just a quick talk with a woman who answered the phone, but she said they had determined that there was no really serious problem with electronic voting. Their board had decided, based on that information, that they weren't going to be opposing it. And
this is the state organization?
The pros and cons. And the last thing she said was that the United States League of Women Voters is not going to be doing anything about this issue. Now, this is, you know, you can take that for what it's worth. This is not an official policy, but I did not get a very pleasant response, and I just wanted to pass that on to you.
That's interesting.
It wasn't encouraging at all.
Well, thank you, Keith. I would encourage if anybody from the Washington State or any League of Women Voters group around the United States is listening to this program and would like to call in and be on the record about this, we would love to hear from you.
Exactly. And, you know, take it from there. But
yeah.
It didn't sound encouraging, so we'll see. Maybe we can pursue that. Thanks.
Thank you, Keith. Thanks for the heads up. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. David in Seattle. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, why has the inferior court chose to
focus first on the illegal redistricting and the violations of the Voting Rights Act in Texas instead of addressing the voting machines. And
by inferior court, I assume you're being sarcastic about the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I've been noticing this pattern since 2004 of, you know, these voting machine companies exploiting particular districts in any given state, and they're trying to force these machines on these districts.
Right. Yeah.
So that it makes it harder for the district, for all the districts in any state, to get on the same page.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And not only that, I mean, there's all these weird incentives. The Help America Vote Act. You know, there are certain things that you have to do, particularly accessibility for the handicapped. And you know, so there's the stick, and there's this huge carrot. There's millions, billions of dollars floating out around, floating around out there that, you know, are being passed along to counties and states.
We're hyper focusing on the elections in Iraq, which is a good thing, I have to say, but they're given so much more leeway. I mean, the way that they're voting and taking 2 weeks to count the vote or whatever,
right?
Versus, you know, the
we want elections like they have in Iraq. We want to vote on paper. That should be our mantra, David. Thank you much for the call. We want to vote just like they did in Iraq. We want purple fingers and we want paper. That's I can see it now. Amy in San Diego, California. Hey, Amy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Hey,
I just wanted to comment. You were talking earlier about the Santa Clara thing and the corporate personhood and all that, and I just wanted to encourage everyone to read your book, Unequal Protection. I'm giving it away as three Christmas presents, and I also bought my dad the JFK book from you. So I
my publishers, thank you. And I do, too. I mean,
yeah, and I wanted to encourage people to go to ReclaimDemocracy.org and check out Jeff Melchin's website. And that, you and Jeff and all those things are what got me started in working hard on publicly funded elections. And I just want to tell you one funny thing. I gave a presentation about clean money in a town here near San Diego, and I mentioned your book, told everyone that they need to be reading that. And everyone in that group, they all they already knew about your book, and they all loved you. And afterwards, I got to talking with a few of them, and we've decided that we don't need democracy if you're the king of the world.
That! No, Amy, then you'd need it even more.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Amy.
Bye.
Yeah, good to hear from you. No, you don't want me the king of the world. I'm sorry. I don't want me king of the world. Daryl in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Daryl, what's up? We have about a minute left before we got to take a break.
Oh, hi. I wanted to get back to the nonstick surface and Teflon.
Oh, yeah, the DuPont with their $10 million fine today for poisoning us.
I have birds. Got them nearly 20 years ago. And when I started to read about taking care of birds, there was notice all over the place, do not have Teflon. If it overheats, it kills birds instantly.
Right, once it starts smoking. And presumably it's because it's releasing this very chemical that they just got nailed for today that we were talking about earlier.
Right, and talk about a canary in the coal mine.
Yeah, the metaphor is absolutely perfect.
That was what came to mind immediately 20 years ago to me. It was, what in the world? If it's that way for birds, if it kills them immediately, what's it doing?
Yeah. Yeah, Louise is right here. We used to have a parrot, and she says, yeah, this is absolutely true. So you're warned about that. Daryl, thank you for letting us know.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Great to hear from you, and thank you for calling into the program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. You want to drop into the live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click live chat, and say hi to the folks there. Say hi to me. Say hi to all of us. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. For a change.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Merry Christmas, babe. You should treat me nice.
Yes, indeed. Happy holidays, my friends. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy New Year, Happy Kwanzaa.
Merry Christmas, baby.
Happy Yule. Happy Saturnia. What is this? War on, you know, the War on Happy Holidays, right? And Bing Crosby. He used to sing Happy Holiday. Have yourself a happy little. No, that was a Merry Christmas, wasn't it? Anyhow, there's a bunch of those. Shouldn't go there. 1-866-888-440-THOM, our number. 1-866-440. We promised we weren't going to talk about the so-called faux war on Christmas anymore, so we won't. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call again. I heard you a little bit earlier and just brought to mind. Just last night I heard some, you know, I happened to hear a talk show host talking, and a real good man, by the way, but it brought to mind, I see an increasing amount of cynicism against the word government.
Well, this has
and
been
this
part of
very,
the campaign.
Very, very disturbing. And I think the, not to interrupt you, I think the Bush crowd, well, they have been using to their, they demagogue it to what's left of our democracy.
Yeah, and Reagan is the one who began it.
Yes.
I mean, you know, Reagan used to make jokes. He said, you know, the 18 most frightening words in the English language are, I'm from the government, I'm here to help, or 16 or however many it was.
Well,
and you know, Reagan was just, you know, very, very good at that, at basically trashing America, trashing government, just trashing the idea of government. In fact, here's Ronald Reagan saying,
I've always felt the
there you go.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yeah, and it was, you know, and it was always, people would always laugh. And the reality is, government is us.
If you don't mind the honest, here's what I say to this crowd. First of all, the government's me and you, obviously. The government's not that bad. We have a Social Security system. They talk about wasting government. What they never talk about, how well run the Social Security system has been from the get-go.
The cost of overhead, less than 1%?
What was it? Like, well, less than 1 or 2%, right?
Yeah, it's less than 1%, and they've never missed a check.
No, they've just been fantastic on it. So they use this to demagogue it, and they use it in their favor because they got nothing to fall back on.
Yeah, no, well here's the reason why they're doing it, Gary. They're doing it because if you can get government out of the way, if you can get the will of we the people out of the way, particularly in with regard to control of the commons, then you can insert private interests in that place because a vacuum will be created. So if government is no longer making sure, for example, that you know, companies are producing safe products, then those companies can produce whatever they want. If government is no longer ensuring that education is good, then private there's opportunities for profit to be made here. And that's the bottom line. It's stripping us of our power, and we the people, through representative democracy and replacing it with a plutocracy.
It's their philosophy or no philosophy. And their philosophy is wrong. And if one thing, if I may add, you can move on, is that here's the perfect example to me. This is beyond the pale. From 1981 to 1988, there was no increase in the minimum wage. Not once. And guess what? The jury is in. There has not been a minimum wage increase from 1995 to 2005. Why? Because the they can't even get it out of committee. These deadhead Republicans are blocking it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And well said, Gary. And the bottom line is that we the people write the rules for the game of business. And increasingly, business is now telling we the people how to write those rules. And that's what's wrong. Martin in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Martin, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. I just wanted to say I was listening when your fellow a while back said they called the League of Women Voters here in Washington and said that they didn't believe or they didn't see anything wrong with electronic voting machines. And I called the League of Women Voters here, and I think I talked to the same lady he talked to, and she said she didn't know how he got that impression because their position is verifiable votes, and however you get to it, that's how you get to it, but no. They don't support electronic voting machines without some sort of verifiable system.
Mm. Now, here's the problem. How do you get a verifiable system as long as the software is in secret?
Well, you print out a paper, and the paper, and you check the paper, and then you deposit the paper. The machine just prints out the paper for you.
Right, but how do you know that so you're just printing out the paper? In other words, as long as the voting machine is simply a fancy printer, I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
And then we're counting the paper. But what's happening is the machine is printing out the paper, plus it is running an electronic tabulation.
I know. I can't imagine anybody buying any of that.
And in many states, they have made, like in Ohio, for example, they have made it against the law to compare that paper against the outcome of that tabulation, that electronic tabulation, unless it's beyond a certain deviation, unless it's more than, for example, a 3% difference in a contest. And the result of that is, if you're going to rig an election, you just now know the parameters by which you have to rig it. So, but in any case, it's good. We'll have to get together with somebody from the League of Women Voters and get their official position on this. Thank you very much for that call. I do appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Joan in Seattle, Washington, you had a great capitalism author. We have just 20, 30 seconds left. You want to just toss it out here? Joan?
Oh, hello.
Hey.
Yes, I wanted to talk to you about Heilbronner, a professor of economics that talks a lot about capitalism. And I'm reading his latest, one of his later books called 21st Century Capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives a tremendous background on how capitalism works, what things influence it. And I was especially interested because he talks about something that you had discussed earlier in the show, and that was the relationship between government and capitalism,
mm-hmm.
and how that can be healthy and how that can be very destructive.
Yeah, good. Heilbronner. Great.
And he almost exclusively writes on capitalism. He's done it for 30 years, and he really gives you a lot of good information.
Good. Joan, thank you very much for that information. I do appreciate it, and thank you for calling the program. I'm sorry we're out of time. It's been another fast day. Thank you very much for being with us today. We look forward to hearing from you tomorrow and vice versa. See you here, same time, same place, here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Remember, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.